a bit relevant. I don't always do things that are relevant necessarily to contemporary situations, but I understand is that, what is that? That's a Chevron night or something? It's about the issue. It pertains to the situation in Israel, you know, about giving back land, especially about Chevron, though. I think there's something, I know everybody focuses in general, I mean, Jews are very attached to the land of Israel, and the idea of giving back is a very controversial idea, but I'm not getting into that whole issue. It's not a political issue. I'm not getting into that. But mostly, I think the strongest emotional connection that Jews feel is with Yerushalayim, you know, with Jerusalem. Even people that want to trade land for peace and everything, but everybody wants to draw the line. The idea of returning Jerusalem seems to be the most difficult. But of course, I agree with all that, but I think that there's something unique about Chevron. And I'd like to sort of illustrate it through the this week's Sedra, Chayesara. Now, you're all familiar with Chayesara, right? Interestingly enough, it talks about the death of Sarah, but the way the Torah describes the story never really fulfills our own expectations. It doesn't provide us with the kind of information that we'd be curious about. Because what is the entire focus of the story? It tells you about the death of Sarah, and what would you like to? What would you really be interested in? You'd really want to know about the mourning, the funeral, what was said, the eulogies, right? Yes. Well, you can actually add some interesting point, the contrast.
Yeah.
Right? The tremendous contrast. rather, what does the story focus on? The entire story focuses on the purchase of a burial place, which would seem to be a very mundane thing. It's clear he needs a burial place, right? But it goes extensively into his negotiations with the people of the land, essentially with Bnei Ches, that was the Hittites, the tribes, you know, that lived there. And of course, we're talking about a place called Chevron. And then he focuses on what's known as the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, that's the burial place. And then he gets into negotiations with Ephron. Ephron owned the field with the cave, And it just seems, you know, the Torah doesn't provide us with too much information, but it seems an extensive negotiation, up and back. And it's a very fascinating negotiation. It's one of those cases where each person is insisting, no, let me pay. You know, no, I insist that Avram is insisting that he wants to pay. He doesn't want it for free. It's choice property. He recognizes that, and he wants to pay the full price. And Ephron, they had tremendous respect for Avraham. And they said, Nasi Elohim Ata, you're a prince of God. So they recognized that he's a great man, and they wanted to give it to him as a gift. So he was put in a very difficult position, because on the one hand, it's a matter of respect. You can't just turn down a gift. You have to be diplomatic about it. You know, you can't just say, no, I insist on paying. And on the other hand, for some reason, he really did not want to take it as a gift. That is an extremely important theme in the story. I'm not going to go into all the details now, because there's a lot of psychology, the way he expressed himself and so forth. I'm not going into all the particulars at a different time. But tonight I want to focus on a few basic questions pertaining to the significance of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the Cave of Machpelah, which, as you know, is more than just a burial place. It assumes a very important significance in our history, and it's important even today, because it's not just not a story that he needed a place to bury, like a plot where you needed a place to bury his wife. He was buried, it was designated for a purpose. It was extremely important. He was buried there. The patriarchs and the matriarchs were buried there. Chazal say that Adam and Eve were buried there as well. I'm sorry?
There has to be some reason why he wanted that.
The things that I want to focus on is, what is the concept? What is the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah? And hopefully to show why it's relevant today, it might even be an important issue with regard to the politics of Israel, although I'm not getting into political issues right now. That's my first question. I have two questions. What is the concept behind the Ma'aras HaMachpelah? What does it represent? What's the idea? Why is it so important? And you see later on, that they buried Avraham in the Maris HaMachpelah, and Yitzchak, and Rivka. And then later, I just want to show you later on, you'll see that the Yaakov makes a very big issue out of it. And he makes Joseph take an oath about making sure that, because he died outside of Israel, he died in Egypt, and he did not want to be buried in Egypt. Instead, it wasn't just that he didn't want to be buried in Egypt, but he insisted that he be buried in the Maris HaMachpelah. So that place is extremely important. The other issue, as I said, was that Avraham insisted upon purchasing it and not accepting it as a gift. And that, seemingly, what difference does it make? Why would it matter whether he accepts it as a gift? If they were, and it's quite clear that they really, you know, wholeheartedly wanted to honor him with it as a gift, and yet he wouldn't do it. You do find, however, that I mentioned, it's not completely true, it requires a certain modification. I mentioned that the patriarchs, the matriarchs and the patriarchs are buried there, except there's one exception, one notable exception, who's not buried there, and that's Rachel. So of course the question immediately arises,
why not?
Right. When Yaakov was returning from his journey, he had gone back to Haran, and that's where he actually married Rachel and Leah, and then eventually he had to return. I'm not going to go through the entire story. And she died tragically. She died in childbirth, but they were very close. She was very close to the land, Bederech Ephras, it says, on the way to Beis Lechem. And he buried her there on the road. He buried her there on the road, which is very, very strange, because he really could have brought her to the Maris HaMachpelah. That's what you would have thought. Now, even if it is far, if he insisted that he be brought from Egypt, which is a bigger journey.
Yeah, but they had certain
bonds. Well, I'm sure that wasn't the factor. I'm sure they had embalming techniques over there too. It could have been done. It doesn't seem that it was a practical issue. Now, where did the Torah does provide? If you take a look at Vayechi, where he expresses for the first time, he never really told Yosef. Yosef was, of course, the oldest son of Rachel. She had two sons, Yosef and Binyamin. And it seems that he never explained to Yosef all those years. Well, actually, it would have been, the 17 years. When he returned, when he was reunited with Yosef, he never explained to him why he had done this until the time came. And as you know, prior to his death, he meets with Yosef, and he asks him to take an oath. When I lie with my fathers, in other words, when I die, that you shall carry me from Egypt, and you shall bury me in their burial place. And then Yosef said, "I will do as you say." And he says, "Swear to me." He wasn't just satisfied with him agreeing. He wanted him to do it, to take it as an oath. Then, if you read on a little bit further, this is right before he expresses the blessings to his children, before he dies, actually. And he then explains to Yosef. And he says, "When I came from Padan," that is to say from Aram, where he had gone to, you know, where he had met Rachel and Leah, where he had gotten married. So Rachel died, Mesa Alai Rachel, she died literally on me. Be'eretz Canaan by Derech, in the land of Canaan on the road. When there was just a little piece of land, a little space between me and Ephras. Ephras is Bethlehem. Today it will be Bethlehem. So she died on the road to Bethlehem. And I buried her there on the road to Ephras, which is Beis Lechem. Now Rashi explains what he was doing. Why was he telling him this now? And Rashi says because he was concerned that Yosef would be upset, that Yosef might be a little angry that he did not, that Yaakov did not give his mother the honor of being buried in the Maris HaMachpelah. Um, And he, Rashi says, even though I did not make the effort to bring her, to bury her in the land of Canaan, nevertheless, I'm still asking you to do this for me. And he says that, Rashi says on the term, and I bury her there, he's meaning I did not even bring her to Beis Lechem, to bring her into the land. And I know that you have complaints against me in your heart. So you should know that I did this in accordance with the command of God. Now, as you're saying now, that this was not just a whim. It wasn't just a laziness on my part. But I had a reason for what I was doing. So that she should be a source of help to her children when they would be exiled by the first exile, Nebuzaradan. And they would say, you know, that he was concerned. There's a reason why she's buried there. That is, that when they would be going into exile, they pass by the way. Now then it says something strange, which of course it's not meant to be taken literally, but so to speak, Rachel comes out of her grave and she cries and she requests a mercy for them. As it says in Tanakh, Kol Barama Nishma, a voice is heard in the heights. And God answers her and says that there'll be a reward for your efforts. Your children will return. Your children, v'shavu v'anam l'gvulam. That's, I think everybody's familiar with that expression, right? V'shavu v'anam. It's very strange, and I don't believe that once you take this literally, that we don't believe, first of all, the idea that we pray directly to God, and I don't want people to get the wrong impression over here. It's not that we need people who are dead to pray for us. That's not the concept. But nevertheless, it's a strange idea. Seems to be coming out of nowhere. I mean, why doesn't answer the question? If everybody else was buried, he himself wants to be buried in the Machpelah. That's the burial place that's designated for the fathers, for the founders of the nation. So I'd like to see if we can make some sense out of that. This seems to just doesn't fit into the pattern. For some strange reason, God. And he's saying it wasn't his idea, he got this from God, but God did not want her to be buried there. Rather, she should be buried outside of the land, like sort of an exile. And she should be some type of a help, I guess, is the best way to put it, for the Jews who are going to be sent into exile. Okay, so those are the questions that I would like to address myself to tonight. Okay? I'm sorry. Now, the basic questions simply revolve around the idea of the Ma'aros HaMachpelah. What is the concept? It's more than just a burial place. It has a very important role to play in the entire life of the Jewish people. As we see, it wasn't just because, if not, you see, if it was just a practicality, so then, you know, the other. Each family, each person has no idea of being buried together. I mean, each person could be buried where the situation is best suited for it. But you see, it's clear that that was a designated place, and all the patriarchs keep referring to that in the place that Abraham purchased. So you see that there's a concept there. Also, I wanted to know why it was necessary that he buy it, that he purchase it for money rather than accept it as a gift when they're willing to give it to him as a gift. And the next question that I had was with regard to the burial of Rachel. That given, if it is for whatever reason, it's necessary that all the founders of the people be buried in this place, so why wasn't she buried? And it wasn't, you can't explain it on the basis of practicality. It wasn't that much of a distance. So yeah, he had a very secret kind of a reason, which on the surface sounds strange. It's like a mystical kind of thing. So I'd like to see if we can make some sense out of it. This whole idea that it was important that that she be buried on the road, so that she should be some type of a symbol for the future generations when they would be sent into exile. And of course that is expressed as though she's coming out of the grave and crying. I don't mean to take that literally. You shouldn't take that literally. because that's the way Chazal, you know, the rabbis communicated ideas to us. Okay. Now, the first question is with regard to the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. What is the foundation behind that? What is the basis of that idea? And I think that is very much tied in to the question of the identity of the Jewish people. And I've discussed this many times, but never in this context. Of course, we regard ourselves as the chosen people. Right? That's something that all Jews, whether they're observant or not observant, basically, most Jews accept that idea. Because it's a very, you know, ego-pleasing idea to be regarded as a chosen people. But it's misunderstood. Because the question is, if God has a chosen people, why did God choose the Jews? Why did he choose us? Now, there's a section in the Devarim which we've read. I'm going to just go over it again. It's very ambivalent. On the one hand, listen carefully. On the one hand, God tells us that he chose us, but not because of any inherent merit that we have. And I'll just read to you quickly. God is saying, do not say in your heart, because God was about to destroy all the enemies that stood before them. When God destroys your enemies and brings you into the land, you should not say, because of my righteousness is God enabling me to inherit the land, and because of the wickedness of these people. In other words, God is warning us very strongly not to allow it to go to our heads. Not to have this feeling that God chose us because we have some innate superiority. Of course, most Jews feel that way. But even in spite of the fact that the Torah told us not to feel that way, because it's a very powerful feeling. But the truth is that we should not feel that way. And then listen very carefully, because it sounds like a real... If anybody else were to say this, you'd say he's an anti-Semite. If somebody were to talk to the Jews this way. It's not because of your righteousness, nor because of the straightness of your heart. Are you coming to inherit their land? But rather because of the evil, the wickedness of the people. In other words, God is driving them out. That's justice, because they sinned and they're wicked. They don't deserve to be there. And in order to fulfill the matter, the oath that God swore to the fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. Meaning to say, and then it says again, be adopted, you shall know that it, again, it's not because of your righteousness that God is going to give you this good land, because you are a stiff-necked people. So it's actually a criticism. I'm not going to go into all what the meaning is that you're a stiff-necked people, but it means to say that very simply, this pasuk over here is saying that it has nothing to do with you, but rather God made a promise to the fathers, and he has to keep the promise. Now, if you look at it, there's one more source, though, that sounds a little bit different. Because here it's a put-down. Here the Jews are... It's not just simply saying that you're not superior, it's sort of criticizing them. But in another place, in Vayis Chanan, it says, when you went to the land, you should destroy all the places of idolatry, lest you be ensnared by idolatry. Then it says, for you are a holy nation to the Lord your God. Here it sounds like a much more upbeat, complementary type of an approach. God chose you to be a chosen people from all the nations on the face of the earth. Not because of your numbers, not because you're bigger than all the other nations, did God desire you and choose you. For you are the smallest of the nations. So it's not because of your size. But why? What is the reason? Because God loved you. Because God loved you. And again it mentions, and because he kept the oath, and because he kept the shvua, the oath that he swore to your fathers. Therefore God took you out of the land with a mighty hand, and he redeemed you from the house of slaves, from the house of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So, what is the resolution? On the one hand it says that, you don't have any righteousness. It's not because of your righteousness. On the other hand, it says that God loves you. Well, it seems to be a bit of a contradiction. So the idea is it says in another place, Rak bavosecha choshak ad Hashem. Only in your forefathers did God have a desire. That is to say that, see, there's two kinds of merit. There are two reasons why someone can merit something. A person can merit something inherently, innately, because he has all the characteristics. Now, that type of merit we don't really have. Who had that merit?
Okay.
The fathers. That's why God allows his name to be associated with only three people. God of Abraham, that's what we say in our prayers. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. These people reach the highest level in terms of the perfection of man, what God intends, the life that God intended for man, and the manner in which man is supposed to relate to God. They fulfill that, and therefore, it was God's will that a people be developed that would perpetuate these ideas for all of mankind. That is the Jewish people. But that's why we have come into the picture. We come into God's plan secondarily because we have the merit, what's referred to as the merit of the fathers. The schus avos. In other words, God loves us in the sense that God relates to us, but not because of something which is inherent in our nature, but rather because we are the most suitable, because we have the good fortune to be the descendants of these people. Is that clear? In other words, the purpose, the reason why the Torah is telling us this is because you shouldn't allow it to go to your head. You shouldn't develop a feeling of nationalistic pride, of being superior, because of everything that's going to take place. You should feel grateful, you should be proud, but proud and fortunate that you have this merit to be part of this people. But really, it is only because of the fact that there did exist individuals in the world who did merit God's closeness and God's providence, and those are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God made an oath, because God didn't want these ideas to die with them. God wanted a people to exist that would perpetuate what God regards as the true way to relate to him, and the best vehicle was the descendants. So therefore, what is the identity of the Jewish people? How do we identify ourselves? As the children, in other words, the definition of the Jewish people is what? The children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is what unites us. What unites us is our identification with our fathers. And by the way, it's not simply, when we speak about that, I mean, our identification with our fathers. Let me ask you a question. So suppose somebody converts. So he also is a Jew, and he's also part of the Jewish people. But if I'm saying that the essence of being a Jew is really means that you regard yourself as a child of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's your essence. So what about the convert? What about someone who converts?
He's even better.
He's on a higher level. That's the Rambam. Actually, there's a letter of the Rambam to a convert, because we say in our prayers, God of our fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God of our fathers. So he asked the Rambam whether when he prays, how can I say God of our fathers when it's not my father? I'm not a biological descendant. So the Rambam answered him and said that, yes, you do say that. Because by father over here, what we mean in the sense of being your guide, philosophical father, your spiritual mentor. That is the idea. You know, by the way, that that's the way the student is referred to as a child. B'nei ha-Nevi'im, the children of the Nevi'im. And when Elio, the prophet, dies, his student, Elisha, said, Avi, Avi, my father, my father. He refers to him as his father. So father in Judaism does not simply mean biological. Of course, it's biological. But it's more than that. It means the one who's responsible for your real existence. So a father, a parent, is responsible for your physical existence. But the true parent is the one who is most responsible for the real existence, for the perfection of your soul, for the knowledge, for the ideas that make you, that's the essence that make your whole life worth living. So in that sense, Therefore, it's very similar. The institution of honor to the Rebbe, to the teacher, is very similar to the institution of honor to one's parents. And as I said, a teacher is referred to as a parent, in a sense. In a sense, the Rambam says, in a sense, you have to give them even more honor, because your parents bring you into this world, and your teachers bring you into the ultimate world, to eternal life. Okay. Strange, though, that if we identify, if our whole identity really revolves around the other, okay, that these are our role models, that's what we're saying. This whole people revolves around, it's more than just, if I don't like the founding fathers, it's more than that, because the founding fathers are not necessarily our role models, they're just historically the ones, but we're different, we're the only people that actually regards ourselves in that light, that throughout all the centuries we still revere the burial place of that this is the land of our fathers. Even today, even a person, somebody the Rabbi Tate mentioned, there was a dinner, and Eric Sharon spoke. That was Sunday, I was at the wedding. And he mentioned, even though he himself said, I'm not a religious person, but the idea of giving of Chevron, I mean, there's no other people that thousands of years later relate to the burial place of their fathers. This idea is a very powerful idea, that this is the land of our fathers. This is what makes it our land, because our fathers lived there. I just wanted to point out, though, that you would think it's strange, though, that usually the role models of a group or a people would be those who actually kept the system, like the system of mitzvahs. Now, it is a bit strange. You would think that the one you look up to as your role model would be someone who's living according to the same system, that they lived before the Torah was given. Did they keep the mitzvahs or didn't they keep the mitzvahs? That's an interesting question. And if you say that they didn't, it seems if you read the story that they didn't keep the mitzvahs, because the mitzvahs were not given until much later. So you would think that the ones who should be your role models would be those who actually are living the same way we're living, keeping the 613 commandments, the entire Torah. I mean, did they keep the Torah? Now, there are statements of the rabbis that they really did keep the 613 mitzvahs and so forth. Yeah, but the Rambam certainly didn't take that literally. So the question is, why would people who didn't even live the same, according to the same religion that we're living by, why would they be our role models? Now, if you take a look at the Rambam mentions that with regard to the mitzvahs, there was a process of development. There was a bit of a development. And that is to say that Adam, Adam HaRishon, was commanded with six mitzvahs he was given. He was commanded about idolatry and about desecration of the name of God. He was commanded against murder, against the forbidden sexual relations, and against theft. And also he was commanded to set up a legal system, a court system. All right? Then he says that when Noah came along, Noah was given permission, because Adam didn't have permission to eat meat. Noah was given permission to eat meat, so he was commanded against what's referred to as a limb. That is to say that you can't take from an animal until it's been killed properly. Okay, in a humane fashion. Then it says that, so there were seven Noahide laws, you're familiar with that. Then it says that this is the way the matter stood until Abraham. Abraham came and he was commanded additionally. He had seven plus circumcision. So Abraham was commanded in circumcision. And Abraham prayed the morning prayer. And Yitzchak set aside tithes, charity. And he also added another prayer, the afternoon prayer. And then Yaakov added a mitzvah. And so on and so forth. Then he says that in Mitzrayim, Amram, who's the father of Moses, was commanded in further mitzvahs. So the way the Rambam describes it was like a process. That the mitzvahs were given, some mitzvahs were given until, he says, till Sinai. Till Moshe Rabbeinu came, and the Torah was completed through him. It seems like there was sort of an evolutionary kind of a process. So, what I think the Rambam is saying is, the reason why we identify with the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and why they are our role models, and essentially the Torah does not describe them. You don't see them depicted as keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher. The Torah doesn't depict them that way, putting on tefillin, and so on and so forth. There's a reason for that, seems to me. And it's to teach us something very, very important. God gave us a system of commandments, but many people make a mistake with regard to the commandments, and they view that the entire religiosity is simply keeping the commandments as an end in itself. You find many religious people that are very, very meticulous about the keeping every detail, every technicality of the commandments, but they're not really concerned about the underlying perfection. You see, that it's a value system. Their whole value system can be all messed up in many, many areas. They can be corrupt in many, many areas, but as long as they fulfill their religious obligations scrupulously, they feel that that's it. That's all that God wants. They take Judaism and they make it into a technical religious system. And they simply forget completely about that the mitzvot are simply a means. And the ultimate objective of all the mitzvot is to perfect the person philosophically in terms of his values. You see? That's what the Avos represent. The fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, represent perfection of man. But they lived a life in which the fundamentals of our system, everything that our system is geared to produce, that was the essence of their life. So Abraham, for example, the true idea of God, the proper relationship that a person is supposed to relate to God through appreciation of God's wisdom, and that the relationship to God should be based upon the element of serving God out of love and not because a person expects that God's going to do different things for him, and the idea of perfecting oneself in terms of one's dealings with one's fellow man because of this relationship with God. He reached the ultimate level in terms of the practice of chesed, fulfilling the will of God in terms of dealing with people. And perhaps most significant of all, the concept of emunah. The idea that if a person has the proper foundation in terms of his conviction about God's existence and the way he relates to God, then he's able to withstand all of the vicissitudes of life, and it doesn't have any effect upon his relationship to God. Those were the 10 tests that Abraham was subjected to. These are all of the fundamentals of human perfection. So it's important, in terms of a role model, the role model should be the one who represents the proper lifestyle, and that's what we see in the others. You see, the Torah describes the others. You don't see people, it's unlike, I mean, like a lot of the books today, the biographies, you know, where it tells you about how they're so meticulous they were in choosing their, you know, the matzah and so on and so forth. Of course, these things are important. But what we really want to see is the life that they led. And that's all that the Torah really tells us about them, is all of the various situations that they were subjected to, and how perfected people react in these situations, and how God's providence will relate to people when they're living in accordance with the proper way. That is why I believe that it's important. Now, it's interesting, there's more to talk about on this, that you see that it wasn't essential. The role models were not people who lived in accordance with the system of 613 commandments, necessarily, certainly according to the Rambam. Because, as I said, you shouldn't think that the essence is the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs, we need the mitzvahs, of course, the mitzvahs are important, but it's to lead you to that goal, it's to lead you to that perfection. If you're not living the lifestyle of Abraham, then all the performance of the mitzvahs is not fulfilling its objective. But you do see it was important. I just think that the Torah didn't want to disassociate them from mitzvahs too, because then a person say, you don't need the mitzvahs, it's just a philosophy. So there was a connection. By starting the process, You see, by starting the process of giving mitzvahs to people who are perfected, it shows the connection, that the mitzvahs really are related to those people who are living a life of perfection. You see? In other words, the Torah didn't want to go to the other extreme of not having any connection, because our concept of the proper life is one which does involve the commandments. You see, you can't ignore the commandments. These are the commandments of God. Therefore, these are the best directives, the best way to lead one's life. But you've got to approach it with the idea that what you're really striving for is not just, because that's what happens to a person. He gets hooked on, you know, the technical performance. It becomes an end in itself, and he forgets about pursuing the real perfection behind the mitzvahs. That's what the Avos rep. That's what the fathers represent. So I just want to say that I think that this is the concept of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. The idea why God directed Abraham to leave his native land and to travel to the land of Canaan, which is Israel, and to travel across the land and call out in the name and set up. He set up different places where he gathered people together to teach them the true ideas, was for all future generations. When we would come there, we would realize, we would recognize that we're entitled to this land only by virtue of the fact that we are the descendants of the fathers, and that this land was designated because these people came here and they led the true life, the ultimate form of the life that God wants man to live in this particular land. That's what sanctifies the land. That, you see, that it's not a nationalistic phenomenon. Most people get attached. Our relationship to the land of Israel is not the same as an American to America or a Frenchman to France. It's a nationalistic phenomenon. Unfortunately, many people look at it that way, because unfortunately many Jews have lost this concept, and they look at the Jews as being just another nationalistic entity. The idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, you see, you always, it's very, very important. The fact, if a person came to a place and he set up a whole new society with a different social structure, with justice and compassion and good laws and so forth, and he wanted to perpetuate it, but then he set up a burial place for the founders that lived this way of life, so then all future generations, when they came, that's very important, it has a very profound effect. When you come to the place that they're buried, and it's not, you have to understand, it's not the fathers, it's the ideas that they represent. That's the ultimate. But you need the concrete phenomena to relate you to the ideas. So therefore, that was extremely, extremely important. A burial place is very, very important. Because you come, you visit, when you do that, it brings back, when you visit the burial place. For example, this, I just happened to hear it on the news today, maybe you heard it, this issue about, with Arlington National Cemetery. Can somebody help me out here? Anybody in contact with what's going on in the world? There's a whole to-do, from what I heard, I don't know how far it went, is that I think, because I just got bits and pieces as I was driving the car, that there was a suggestion that I think Clinton was thinking about selling, you know, fundraising is a big thing these days, people would have the right to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery.
Wow, no way.
But people were calling in and saying, well, that these are people, this is designated to be the place, these are people that actually gave up their life for our liberty, for our existence, and so on and so forth. It really hurts. How can you do a thing that's sacred? Whatever. I'm not getting involved in that issue right now, but I'm just trying to show you how significant it is when people go to Washington, and then they visit the grave, and they actually see this is living testimony that there were people that did give up their life, that did fight, gave their blood for this particular, that has an effect upon people. Then you know why you have a country. You know why you have liberty and freedoms, and you have a different attitude towards it. Now, in a similar vein, the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, it brings to mind the entire reason for our existence and why it is that God gave us the land and what we're supposed to do in that land. And if we forget that, then we're not the Jewish people anymore. For example, you know the famous story that even before the Jews entered the land, this Maros HaMachpelah, this cave had significance. That the spies, Kalev, separated from the spies and he went to Hebron. He went to Hebron to pray. It says he stretched himself out on the grave of the Avos, of the patriarchs, to pray that he should not be seduced by the plan, the conspiracy of the spies. So what's going on there? Is that a mystical kind of thing? It is, certainly is not. The difference is very subtle. It's not always obvious. A person can go, going to a grave. A person goes to visit a grave can be a positive, beneficial experience. Because it all depends, or it could be extremely negative. It could be one of two possible extremes. If it's, for some people, it's sort of a mystical type of a thing where you have this desire to communicate with the dead and, or for them to intercede in the heavenly court for you, so you're already, it's involving you in idolatrous types of things. That's a negative kind of thing. That's a negative phenomenon. Because that's it, a person should accept the fact that there's nothing evil about death, that physical existence has its purpose, and if the person has lived properly, once they die, so the soul continues to exist. However, to go to visit, we're only human beings. When you are in the presence, for example, if we were to go on a trip and go to visit the grave of the Rambam, that will have an effect upon us. It becomes, his whole existence becomes more real, but what we should relate to is not the any deification in that person. That's the problem. You see, there are certain graves today that people visit, and it's based upon something mystical and magical. If, however, somebody visits a grave of a relative or someone who is important to them, there are moments in your life when you need that kind of an inspiration. That's the idea of a role model. And you remember, that's why the Torah is so wonderful. We read about, because everything that is going to happen in our lives, you'll find the source for it in the Torah. Every problem you find yourself in, every temptation, every tragedy that you can possibly experience, if you've studied the Torah and Tanakh, you'll find cases. We read about David HaMelech and his trials and tribulations, and even when you fall and you falter and you're down and out and you're feeling loaded with guilt, and you can read about tzaddikim that also sinned. That's the greatness of the Torah. So you can always find someone that went through that experience and learn how a wise person dealt with it. That's an inspiration. That's something that nobody else has. You see what I'm saying? So when you, but there's a certain reality, since we are human beings, when you are in the actual, it has more reality for you. There is reality, let's face it, there is a reality to the fact that you know for sure that this is the burial place of Abraham. That has an emotional impact upon you, but as I said, the real purpose of that emotional impact is to awaken the mind. If it's just that, you see, what was he praying about? Because that was the whole fear of the spies, that they were overwhelmed by their fear of the power of the nations. So that whole idea, that whole concept of being overwhelmed by human might. And he retraced the lives of the fathers and what they had to go through and how they were able to overcome overwhelming odds because they acted intelligently and because of God's providential relationship to them, and that if God is on your side, then you, and in an intelligent kind of way, then you'll be successful. That's what he relived, and that's what gave him the strength. But in order to awaken that idea and that emotion, it was necessary to actually be there. So the physical burial place itself is extremely important. And Avraham understood that. And that's why he had to make a permanent reminder for the nation of what it is that this entire venture, this entire enterprise is all about. It's about the fact that these are people who have discovered the true ideas of God, and God related to them, and therefore they were involved in establishing a nation which would perpetuate these ideas. And that's why it was vital that in the land itself, because that's the, as Moshe warns them, when you come to the land, then you're going to forget. Then you'll become like any other nation, and you'll develop a military, and you'll be powerful, you'll be successful, and then you'll go crazy, you'll forget what your true purpose is. That's the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Now, I just wanted to mention with regard, so you'll ask, so what about the issue with Rachel? Why was Rachel not buried there? And what's this concept that she comes out of a grave? You see, I think it means that that Yaakov foresaw that there'd be a time when they would lose the land. Which shows us that the connection to the land, is not you know, something because of any superiority. It's because we're fulfilling it. It's the will of God that we should establish a certain type of society. And that when the Jews would reach a certain level of corruption, they'd be driven out of the land. But then they'd be totally devastated, and they would think that it's over. That the entire thing is over. We don't have a land anymore. And the point is that the Jewish people transcend the land. That even though we can only reach our ultimate objective in the land, we need a land because the exile is a very diminished situation, but nevertheless, the essence of the Jewish people, the essence of this identity, it transcends something physical. That even in a state, that was what he wanted them to be uplifted. That even in a state of exile, you still can retain your identity. Provided that you have a proper understanding of what the essence of the Jewish people is about. And that was Rachel.
I think it's easy to see why Rachel more than any of the others. Because she had probably the most tragic existence. She had a very tragic existence, and disappointments in her life. And nevertheless, she never lost. She really represents the exile experience is really the quintessential Amuna experience, because that's when you don't see the hand of God. That's when that test upon him. That's when it's hidden. In fact, Chazal wanted to change the bracha. To remove Akela Gad Gibor, where's God's Gvura? When they're in the exile, where's God's Gvura? The Jews are dispersed throughout the world. So Chazal said, no, it's hidden. How does one lamb survive among 70 wolves? That is to say, that it's a different manifestation of God's Gvura. Yeah, but it's a different manifestation. It's there, but it's not that obvious. It's not that blatant. It's an emunah existence. It's a faith existence. And that's basically the life. If you go into detail, you'll see the life of Rachel. The essence of emunah. I mean, she was deprived even of her husband. She had to share her husband with her sister. That wasn't what was supposed to be. He was tricked. And she couldn't have children. And she died young. Died in childbirth. I mean, she had a very, very tragic type of an existence, and yet, she did not give up. It had nothing to do. No, she did not give up her faith in God. So that's basically, she really serves the same purpose. But the rest of the other of the patriarchs are the role models for the Jews in a state when they're settled in the land. And she, so that's the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. The Ma'aras HaMachpelah really represents the proper role model of the Jewish people, and why it is that you merit this land, and what your identity is. Rachel is the role model for the Jews in the situation of exile. You see, in other words, the Jews would have two historical existences. One would be an existence in the land, and one would be an exile existence. And in either case, they would need to have something to remind them of their true identity, and that would have to be one of the patriarchs. And as I said, the others, those who are buried in the Machpelah, they play that role for the Jews in the state when they're in the land. And of course, Rachel, that's the v'shavavanim levulam. That's the whole idea that God says that you, there'll be a reward for what you're doing, because this will keep, the Jews will never ever lose their identity, even in exile. And because of that, eventually they will return. So the last point that I wanted to resolve, about the issue about, now let's get down to the money. Let's talk about the money. I mean, all the things he's saying, of course, he wanted it to be firm. He wanted it to be, it's not just simply that we happen to, you know, sometimes a person happens to be in a place and just happens to be buried there. Kinyan means that it's something which I acquire by right. That was the whole idea. If you read afterwards, it says after that, Vayakam stay Ephron, and the field of Ephron emerged, which was in the Machpelah, the field and the cave and so on and so forth, for Avraham Lamikna, as an acquisition, in the eyes of all of the people of Bnei Ches, for everyone that came in. You know, he didn't bury it right away, interestingly enough. First he waited until it became an accepted reality by all the people around, that this was his acquisition, that this is something that he, it means to say that he acquired it by right. Of course, the real right that he acquired it by is, it's really the acquisition. It's the acquisition of the land of Israel. He acquired the rights to the land of Israel by virtue of the fact that he traversed the land and he proclaimed the name of God. But he wanted his relationship to the burial place to be one of an acquisition. Now, interestingly enough, now the Gemara learns out laws. What does it learn out? In marriage. That a man acquires a wife. That a man can acquire a wife, I hate to sound crass, but I mean just describing the law, with kesef. That's one of the mechanisms. That's the ring. We give the ring. The ring is a manner of acquiring a wife because it has monetary value. Okay, so we use the ring. The custom is to use a ring, but essentially it's really only because the ring has monetary value. And it learns it out from the word kicha, because it says kiyikach, if a man take a wife, kicha, the Hebrew term is kicha. And over here it says that Avram said to them that Nasati, he says to Avram, says Nasati kesef asada, I have given you the money of the field, kach mimeni, please take it from me. So it's kicha kicha m'stei Ephron. Have you ever learned Kedushin? That's the famous so-called Gezer Shev. Kicha kicha from m'stei Ephron. So there's a connection between what's happening over here, Avram's purchase of the land, and when a person marries a woman. Because just like the same term, take, is used, and it's in reference to the money that he gave, so too do we learn out, the Torah said, if a man take a wife. So it meant, by giving her money, he takes her. It means to say like this, you see, so that's Kedushin, he consecrates, there's a consecration. The woman becomes sanctified to him. There's a change in the status of the woman as a result of this transaction. That's the same thing over here. That as a result of this transaction, he sanctified the land. He sanctified. The sanctity of the land came about as a result of this transaction, that he established a permanent connection between his lifestyle and this land. So what is Israel? Israel is the place where three giants lived the proper lifestyle. That's what we should think about when we think about Israel. That's why I say that it's true that I mentioned that I'm a bit critical about what people do and they go and visit the Kotel, the Western Wall. And because it seems to me that they're making it to some kind of mystical, magical thing, and then they're doing things that are not really mandated by the Torah. You know, sort of like making up your own religion. And I spoke about, we're learning about that today in Masoret, in the Rambam, about how dangerous it is for people to invest objects. That's the rare, because the Rambam is giving the whole history of idolatry, how idolatry came into being, and essentially it had to do with objects, that people began to make images. And once a person makes an image, he's already in the world of idolatry, because he's already in the world of attributing powers to that which is created, to beings that don't have these powers. So that's a very serious, serious thing. And you see a lot of that today, that people always look for like these little charms, good luck charms, and they take things like these red threads, and they put it over the grave of Rachel, you know, Kevin Rachel, and then they wear it around, and it gives them a certain protection. And people also view like the mezuzah sort of protects the house, so it becomes a superstitious phenomenon. That's absolutely false. And one is not permitted to believe that, if it's taken literally, that there's any physical protection. And it reaches, monstrous proportions, to the extent that if a tragedy happens, they'll say, well, maybe there was a letter. They'll check the mezuzah. A letter was missing. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible idea to believe things like that. So I was saying, the mezuzah is extremely important, but the Rambam says that the mitzvos are not a cure for the body. They are a cure for the soul, that it is important that a person should always be reminded of what his purpose is. Just like with the land, what's the purpose? So when a person, that's what he says, when a person enters into his house, of course the house is a place which affords him an environment of protection, but he should realize that the real purpose is that he should encounter the true ideas, the ideas of God's existence, the unity of God, so that every time a person enters and leaves the house, this is not, people kiss them as though, you know, it's like kissing them, all these things become like these mystical, magical kinds of actions. That's not the purpose. He should pause and think about the ideas. And then when he enters the house, he will use his house for the proper purpose. That's the idea. Mezuzah is extremely important, but not the way people...
But you don't have to kiss
them. You don't have to kiss. Yeah, you got to check the mezuzah twice in 7 years. That's what I said. But if there's any truth in that, that if there's a letter missing from a mezuzah, your whole family can get wiped out. So then how can you only check? You should check it every day. I mean, there's a danger to, you know... Why even live in a house with them? Live in a tent where you don't need a mezuzah. Be safer that way. Now, my differentiation is that the kotel, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I would say that it's much more important, the way I see it, today, in today's situation, Hebron, it seems, is more important. Because that's a place that all Jews have to go to, because you see that Jews have still retained the idea that we are the only people that regard ourselves as children of our founders, of our fathers. There's no other nation that has that. And so that's the first step. Of course, you have to go from there to recognizing the ideas. It's not just a biological thing. You have to go from there to recognizing their ideas and studying their ideas. But that has value and importance today for us. Whereas I'm not trying to diminish the importance of Jerusalem, but Jerusalem functionally today really doesn't have any importance. Because Jerusalem has importance in terms of the temple and the sacrificial system. We don't have that today. So I'm not putting down the importance of Jerusalem. Obviously I'm not, but it seems to me that from the practical angle, Hebron has an importance that's very important today in terms of what the Jewish people need the most. An understanding of their essence, of their soul, of what makes us a Jewish people and why we're in that land. What we're supposed to accomplish in that land is to bring to fruition the life that was lived and was given down to us by our fathers. That's why I'm saying that the idea that the story is teaching us about the Maris and Machpelah, where the patriarchs are buried, has profound significance and should affect, or could affect to a certain extent, the political situation. Because then in the scale of things, it would be a tremendous blow to the Jewish people to lose Hebron. Because that's the essence. That's the essence of why you have the land. That's why they designed the burial place for that very reason. You see, from a practical, functional point of view, it seems to me that it has greater meaning and significance today. Not Jerusalem, again, doesn't have any practical significance today.